This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey everyone, Gil Gross here, and it is time for another mailbag. Jimmy Arias joins us this week to answer your questions, hot takes, observations, and ultimately your comments about tennis or anything else. I love talking the game with Jimmy, not only because he brings insights as a former top five pro, a current coach and commentator, but also because he never fails to give his unvarnished opinion, which not all people in his position can ultimately say. I asked him about Danielle Collins. He was in Collins's box when she won the Miami Open final. That was the start of what has been an absolute 2 to 3 month heater that Collins has since gone on. And Jimmy has some unique insights into that, which I think you're going to enjoy. He also called the Nadal match and the Djokovic match last week for Tennis Channel. We get into that. Don't worry, it's not, you know, the same stuff that I talked about on Monday Match Analysis this week. I feel like we kept it fresh when it comes to Nadal and Djokovic, and we look forward into the future Roland Garros retirement and beyond, have those conversations. And of course, I posted on the YouTube community tab, we're going to get into your comments about things like team not getting a wild card at Roland Garros, who might take advantage of what is a weakened top of the men's field at Roland Garros coming up, whether it be Tsitsipas or Zverev or Ruud, like who do we like out of that group? Other guys too. We get into Jack Draper and a whole lot more, especially you're going to want to see the end where we go kind of rapid fire and cover a lot of ground. So coming up, Jimmy Arias right after this. The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated French Open in years, and Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your smart TV or your phone live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to continue their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it all happens. We're joined for the first time by Jimmy Arias, former top five player, director of player development at IMG Academy. We're repping. We got the courts, the indoor facility in the background, and of course, a tennis analyst that you hear over the airwaves of Tennis Channel and Sportsnet and US Open, and I'm probably missing one or two. Jimmy, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. No problem. Always excited to be here. Yeah, excited to be here. It's all good.
Love it. No, I'm excited to have you. I love the multiple perspectives you have. You know, you're locked in on the pro game. You're locked in on one of the premier junior academies in the United States, certainly. So you have your eyes on the future all the time. And I'm excited to get into it. I got to start by asking you a question that I apologize. I'm sure there are a lot of people in your life who have asked you this question many times in the last couple months, but it has to do with IMG. You're close with Danielle Collins, and what's happened in the last couple months has been incredible. 18-1 since Miami. Can you try to explain this to us? The retirement announcement in January, and now the best stretch of her career, really, really dominating the last couple months.
Well, I think it's all because of me, to be honest. what's interesting about it is she came here to the academy. Like, I think you remember, some people remember, that after she won Miami, she gave me some props, which was in her speech afterwards. And it was somewhat interesting to me simply because I hadn't spent that much time with her. It was almost undeserved props in some ways. But I think the reason for it was because she came here after losing in Indian Wells to the Academy. And I asked her if she would speak to the girls program. And she did. And after she finished, we walked from the courts into the parking lot and maybe spent another 20 minutes. And the gist of what I was talking to her about was two things. One was her game, that I said to her, when you play your best, you're fiery. Even when you get angry, you're showing emotions, you're pumped up. When you're doing good things, you're showing it. When you're doing bad things, you're showing it. That's when you've always played your best. And when I've watched you in the last couple of years, you're very flat. You're not showing as much emotion. And I said, if I were you, I would be faking it a little bit, start getting yourself back to the old fiery self. And I think that's going to help you, even if you're not feeling it at the beginning, just fake it. And I do think she's done some of that. The other part of that conversation was more of, are you really going to retire? Just, I wanted her to keep in mind that making money is much more difficult in the rest of your life than it is for playing tennis. You're never going to make this kind of money again unless you're really working hard, as I can attest to. So be sure this is what you want to do with retiring. And she was sure she wants to do that still. But we kind of had I think she enjoyed the fact that I was concerned for her the rest of her life in some way, even though we hadn't had that much. I've spent time with her over the years, but not a lot. And then I think what happened in Miami, which was interesting to me, was her first round. I'm there because I'm watching Martin Dahm Jr. I'm watching Jerry Zhang. I'm watching, you know, some of our younger students that got wild cards or, you know, got in the main draw. And there was a brief lull in when any of our players were playing, and she was playing against Bernarda Pera, I think, first round. And she, I saw on the score thing that she's down 4-3. So I decided I'd go over and check it out. She loses two games in a row. She has no one in her box, no coach, no anybody. So I sit in that player area. And I just say to her after she loses the first set 6-3, I said, Danielle, I know that she wants to rip. Okay. So she's taking a big swing and she's off balance. Her body is moving a little bit as she's taking this big swing and she's missing. And I just said, Danielle, got to keep the balance. I want you're moving around, keep the body still, shorten up your backswing, but still rip. Because that's her mindset. She's got to be crushing the ball. And she wins 1-1. So I look like a genius, but whatever. It just, you know, it gave her something to focus on, and she wins 1-1. And then she asked me after that match, tomorrow, can you feed me balls? And I said, no, sorry, I can't. I got 10 people I'm looking at. I'm not going to feed balls. So I didn't, again, undeserved that I got as much love in some ways as I did. I don't spend the rest of the tournament with her. The only reason I was there in the finals was because IMG had a kids clinic that morning. I'd already come back once everyone had lost. I had already come back to IMG. I drove down that morning, did this clinic. As I'm leaving the ground, she sees me. I say, Danielle, amazing. It's awesome. Congratulations, playing great. And she goes, could you please watch the final? I go, yeah, sure. So I go and sit. She's getting ready for the match. Mm-hmm. And I sit with, she now has a guy there that's coaching her, I guess, and her boyfriend. And I asked them, we're having lunch. And I said, what do you think Danielle wants from me? And they go, just give her support. Don't tell her anything. Don't give her any technical stuff. She's figuring things out on her own. I go, okay, fine. So 5-all in the first set. I'm already done that part poorly because two or three times she missed shots and told us to stand up. I'm not standing up when you miss a shot. I don't even get the concept. So I didn't stand up. Jesse Pegula actually sent me a text saying, Jimmy, why won't you stand up? It was a very funny sort of scene because he kept yelling, stand up. And I'm not standing up. You just missed. Anyway, so 5-all game. She saves 3-4 break points. She ends up winning that game. And as she's changing sides to come to put her towel in the box, it's on our side now. She's up 6-5. She's won that tight game on her serve. And she's looking right at me. And I just said, Danielle, this game, because she was doing a little bit of the same thing that I saw in the first round. She was trying to take a big cut at Rybakina's big serve, and she wasn't making that many of the returns. So I said, this game, I want your goal. She's upset that she didn't break right now. She's going to feel the pressure serving here. Your goal is to put every ball in. If it touches your racket, you put it in right down the middle on the returns, big targets, make her play this game. And she broke it love that game. So now I'm looking like a genius again. So then second set goes, same thing happens at 3-all. She gets a break, in a long game. I mean, she holds serve in a long game. I tell her basically the same thing. She breaks, she's serving at 30 love. And in that game, Rybakina from 30 love to 30 all, when she's serving for the match, Danielle, Rybakina played the two best points she had played in the match to that point, played two great points. And all of a sudden Danielle comes over and looks at me and goes, what do I do? She was panicking at that point. So then I actually call. I said, serve body, look for the short ball. She served body, got a short ball. The next call I made was poor. I said, serve to the forehand. And Rybakina was waiting on the forehand and hit a pretty good return. And anyway, the game goes on. She wins the match. It's her, you know, biggest win and one of the turns she really wanted to win. And that's why I think she gave me all the love. I do think she's a confidence player and she now has that fire back for whatever reason. I do think she's still going to retire at the end of the year, which is shocking. I actually said to her, why don't you just retire as number one in the world? And I mean, there's a possibility she might, the way she's playing.
Well, maybe it was the prize money thing. You know, you told her that it was difficult to make money post-career. And she's like, well, if I just win every tournament, you know, I might actually
worry about that. Yeah,
I might get enough in the bank just in the next 4 months to sustain myself.
Yeah.
You know, with the retirement thing, the interesting thing is it was never about the tennis, right? Like she was never someone who I'm retiring because I can't sustain my tennis career right now. Like we're seeing with, I don't know, Dominic Thiem and Diego Schwartzman just in the last week. It's like a totally separate category of because of where I'm at in my life, I don't want to continue playing. And in that way, it's almost like the results are completely separate and detached. Her tennis results are detached from that retirement decision. And when you look at it that way, it makes a lot more sense.
I think she wants the family.
Go ahead. Yeah, exactly. I'm just trying to make sense of why now the best tennis of her career after the announcement she made. You know, I'm just trying to put the pieces together, and it's an incredible story in Miami. And another thing that stood out to me that I want to bring up, Jimmy, is she's gone long swaths of her career coachless. Like I talked to her at the US Open last year. I interviewed her after a win and kind of asked her about, you know, how she was in better form compared to earlier in the year. And she talked about just having someone to travel with and someone in her coaching box and just that allowing her to be happier off the court and just improving her mindset. It almost seems like she's someone who really kind of is aided by coaching, but oftentimes for whatever reason has no coach.
Yeah, hard for me to answer that. One of them, it's probably she's not the easiest person to be the coach of, because she does, when she is in full flight, she's going to start yelling at you. But a lot of players are yelling at their coaches and the coaches all take it. So I don't think that's what stopped her from getting a coach. I think maybe she just didn't. That one is on her. I don't know if she just didn't feel the value there, the cost value of a coach in. For her, maybe she's just thinking most of the time the coach is there to stand up when I yell at him to stand up and yell, come on, when I tell him to say, come on. And do I really need that? You know, I'm not sure. I definitely know I did help her a little bit in Miami, and maybe that's why she gave me, just with getting her mind settled a little bit in those moments when she needed her mind to be settled.
Yep, simple stuff, but good stuff.
I never thought coaching on the pro tour was, I didn't have a coach. I know Nick Bollettieri is supposed to be my coach. He never came to the tournaments. I was my own coach the whole time, partly because coaching during a match wasn't allowed. And I felt like I was pretty good at problem solving for myself in a sense. So I didn't feel like I needed the coach. Nowadays, it's a little different because now you can be coached, and there's a lot of things a coach can see that you're not feeling. You're not noticing when you're on the court so much, because especially when you start losing confidence and you start panicking sometimes. And that happened to me sort of at the end of my career. I could have used someone to help me figure out what the heck is going on.
What about like the loneliness factor? I feel like the coach gives you some sort of team environment, the community feel. Were you all right? Were you traveling alone, or did you have non-coaches who were
I traveled alone from when I was 16, because that's when I came on the tour full time. So 16 to 23, I traveled alone for 7 years. And then I met my wife, and she came with me for the next 4 or 5 years. So that made, I probably would have quit earlier. I quit already when I was 29. I probably could have quit at 25. It was a lonely existence, the tour. It's kind of an interesting thing. I don't like saying this because I have kids that want to be pros. But there was a point in time when, even when I was doing well, I remember when I won Rome and I had to get on a plane the next day and go to play again. And the French was right around the corner. I think I played a tournament right after Rome and then played the French. And I remember thinking, wow, this is what I worked my whole life for. This is such a grind. And also when I traveled, there was no internet. There was no, I read a lot of books, but that was about it. There was no TV. I couldn't watch Italian TV and know what was going on. I couldn't watch that kind of stuff. So it's just a lot of reading and a lot of time by yourself. And that wasn't really my favorite thing, I got to say. I'm pretty proud of myself that I made it for as many years as I did.
Yeah, no, it's a quite unnatural life. All right, I'm going to get this back on track, but this has been, fun thing to get into. You called on Tennis Channel Nadal and Djokovic getting crushed on back-to-back days. And I feel like there was a moment on the broadcast of the Djokovic match, which was second, where it kind of hit you how strange this all felt. Was there a moment you were like, what has this been here? Like it just felt different.
Yes, because it's been 20 years really that the same couple of guys have dominated everything. And I had been getting not annoyed, but worried in a sense. And I still have that little bit of a feeling that it's not natural the way it's gone, because these guys, Nadal and Djokovic right now, their skill set, the way they've been playing so far this year, has diminished quite obviously, quickly. The way they're playing right at this moment. That's not to say that they won't get it back for Roland Garros. I can't say, they've been so great that I can't say that they're not going to still be great and this was just an anomaly. But what I prefer to see is the normal course of history in tennis. Great players, they might get a little bit worse, but the youngsters catch them. And the youngsters do something better, and they just get better. They're bigger, stronger, faster, and they're better players, and they eventually knock them out and finish them off. This group, the Federer, Nadal, Djokovic group, and even Murray to some extent, it's just because he got hurt. That group, like Federer just aged out at some point. He didn't get beat. He wasn't ever getting beat. Djokovic never getting beaten until right now. Nadal just got injured and never was getting beat. When he played, he was still one of the best two or three players in the world every time. And the youngsters would come and they'd try and they'd still lose in the end. And that was driving me a little bit nuts, because it gives them, they're never going to have the respect of being a great player when you can't beat the people that, until they just, sorry, I'm 75 years old and I can't play anymore kind of feeling. So it still bugs me a little bit that that seems to be when I watched Nadal's match, he just was a half step slower and his ball just had a little less on it. So Hubie was able to hang in the points and eventually maneuver him around even on clay. And, you know, Hurkacz does defend pretty well for a big fella. He was able to defend well, serve well enough, and just sort of dominate that match. The Djokovic thing, I'm hoping maybe he did have a concussion from the bottle hitting him on top of the head. And he really, because he was completely off balance. That's when he plays badly in his career. It's always been a little bit where you see him flopping around. When he's great, he's totally still and the body is perfect. The angles to everything are perfect. Normally, all that causes him to lose balance is being overly nervous. The U.S. Open, when he was going for the calendar year Grand Slam, where he cried in the finals before the match was over against Medvedev. That whole tournament, he was horrible. He made the finals simply because he's Djokovic in some ways. I think people just didn't think they could win whatever it was. He had to struggle through every match where he was too, his body was off, his balance was off, and you know, it took somebody like Medvedev to not be intimidated by the moment and by the player and able to go ahead and beat him. I don't know if this one felt like there's no reason for him to be overly nervous in the third round of Rome that he's won six times. So I don't understand why, you know, unless it's a concussion, why he was so off balance. And maybe it's just lack of matches. I don't know.
Hard to understand, but against Sinner, similar. Against Nardi, similar. And that's where it becomes more difficult to say, well, he got hit in the head with the water bottle, so we're just going to ignore this one. Because 100%, if things look different for the rest of the year, we would have said, he got hit with the water bottle, ignore this one. Like 100, I think that would have been the easy conclusion. Yeah. All right? Let me read you a quote from Djokovic that I just saw on Twitter from Ali. Quote, the four-year-old Novak is still inside and still in love with this sport and still hungry for more. But at the same time, there's probably a more mature Novak, a father and a husband, who's like, come on, man, there's other things in life too. Part of me always wants to keep going. I don't have an expiration date. I'm lucky to have my life. But some mornings, I'm unmotivated and less inspired to travel and to playing when I want to be at home and have a normal life.
I mean, that's the beginning of the end when you start talking that way. And I think part of that could be that he feels reasonably confident that he's sewn up the greatest of all time with the numbers. So I think the minute, you know, he might get a little more motivated if somehow Nadal is resurrected from the dead and wins Roland Garros, you know, in a couple of weeks. If that happens, I guarantee you Djokovic will be getting up and practicing and trying to get himself back. But I think if he feels as though I've got the greatest of all time wrapped up, he's not gonna work. I've been amazed at how they've stayed motivated, those players, with the results that they've had over the years. It's because, as we were talking earlier, the tour is a grind. They've been doing it for two decades and winning and playing so many matches. It's always pressure, especially expectations. You're supposed to win. It's not even a feeling of what joy. I've done something I've never done before. This is fantastic. It is, thank God I managed to win that one again. It's more of a relief factor than a joy at that point when you've done as well as they've done. So that's why it's going to be difficult to ever recreate what those three players created, I think. It might happen again, but it won't be easy.
The only explanation, because you're right, it's just insane how motivated they all stayed through their mid-30s. They were pushing each other, right? Like, it was just a competition between the three of them, and iron sharpens iron, which is like such an important dynamic in tennis that I'm sure you see even at your academy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. But
that's what you try to do at the academy, actually, is get the kids to compete with each other.
Right.
And nothing is more intense than competing with the people you see every day, because you go to school with them after, and how did you do today? Oh, he beat you. Yeah. Okay. And that sort of thing makes it even more intense than just a normal practice. And because those three were the only three, and, you know, again, Murray was in that equation for a few years. Those three or four guys, they only cared about each other. How do I beat this guy? How do I beat this guy? They knew they were going to beat the other players.
Yeah. I'll weigh in quickly on the Djokovic quote, and then we'll move on to the questions. I mean, I read that and I thought, natural, right? Like, records broken, main rivals fading, off-court life thriving. Like, this was a matter of if not when. And I think, you know, even viewers of and listeners of this show are maybe even tired of the topic, because I've been saying for 3 years that Djokovic's body looks so pristine that it's likely going to be the motivation thing that goes downhill. I thought the Olympics would sustain the fire this year. Maybe it still will as we get closer to the Olympics. But other than that, I mean, again, this is just, this was inevitable at some point.
Sure, he needs a gold medal.
Yeah.
So he does need that just for his whole history thing. So we'll see.
It should fire him up. And then it'll be interesting to see if he can
bring it. You know, bring the game.
Exactly. And then obviously Roland Garros. Now, I said earlier in the year when he lost to Nardi at Indian Wells, looked horrible. And I said, we'll know what this year is going to be after Roland Garros. But before that, I don't think we'll have such a great idea. So, you know, I guess I'm sticking with that right now.
Yeah, I like the call.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right. This is not going to be off topic with the first viewer comment. Comes from Jayan Woods. Do you think Nadal really will end his career this year? I'm not so sure based on the following. I was already thinking last week that due to the difficulty at his age of getting his body back to a fitness level that can withstand full tournaments, he knows that his positive progress in the last few weeks has most likely come too late for Roland Garros this year realistically. But if he manages to keep progressing without setbacks, at the end of this year, he could be at a good level, and in which case it would make sense for him to go for one last Roland Garros in 2025, where he might have a chance to end with a final or at least a good result. Then a few days ago, he said he wasn't 100% sure that this was his last time playing Rome. Winky face emoji. So the question here is really like, do we believe that Nadal's retiring?
I mean, this one's a hard one for me to answer for a number of reasons. One of them is I thought he was probably going to retire at 25 or 26 because of the way he played. I felt like he was a Bjorn Borg in a sense that he, every point was the most important point he's ever played. His game is so physical, the way he plays. The lengths that he goes to hit forehands takes a whole lot of energy to get all the way over to one side and then you're sprinting to the other side of the court. And he's still kind of trying to do that and play that way. He did it a little bit less in the Hurkacz match maybe than he has in the past. But so I've always thought it would amaze me if he plays into his mid-30s just because his game was so physical and the mental grind of the way he played is also a grind. It's not, he didn't get a lot of free points. I can understand why Federer, it's easier for him to play longer. I know Sampras retired fairly early after winning a U.S. Open, but his training didn't have to be so harsh as a player like Nadal. I think it'll be strange for Nadal to have had ceremonies of this is my last tournament in Madrid and Barcelona and those things, and there, you know, and then all of a sudden come back. I don't know if he, and if he doesn't come back and play those, could he play well at Roland Garros in 2025? Who knows? My answer is I don't know the answer. I have no idea. I the way he moved, he was a step slow when I saw him against Hubie Hurkacz, and he's not going to win if he's a step slow. And if he's not winning, he's not gonna, I don't think he'll keep playing if he's 30 in the world.
Especially when the serve doesn't give him anything cheap. I mean, if you lose baseline speed, that's one thing. It's one thing if you serve big, right? My answer to that.
I couldn't understand why he wasn't serving the slider. His wide slice wasn't that wide against Hubie. That was the part that he was trying to serve almost harder.
Yeah.
It wasn't really getting the width. And that seemed like a huge mistake to me. But anyway.
No, you're right, Jimmy. The speeds were up from what they had been the previous tournament, but the effectiveness was zero.
Zero. It was driving me nuts watching him. Quit trying to hit it hard. He's making every return. It's straight in the box. He's in the middle of the court. Anyway.
My answer to the question is I don't know either, but I hope not. Like, you can get into this cycle where with Rafa, I don't think he's never going to lose the ability to hit a forehand. So there's always going to be the hope that, okay, we're going to start to win matches. And I mean, he's beaten a top 15 player already on this comeback in Alex de Minaur, just as an example. So like, it's never going to be, I can't win a tennis match, but I have no faith in his ability to stay healthy. And if the goal is to end the career on the court and not on a trainer's table or in surgery, if that's the goal, at a certain point you have to say, okay, I'm done, I'm good. And I mean, if you continue to delay this, Rafa is not going to get what he wants, what he said he wants, which is to just finish his career on the court in a way that feels acceptable to him, in a dignified way.
Yeah, and it's hard to, we won't know the answer to that. And his body has broken down badly, obviously, over the last couple of years. So, and his game is very physical. So it wears on his body as well.
Next one from Charlie. What are your thoughts on Dominic Thiem not getting a wild card into the French? Personally, I am shocked they wouldn't give a two-time French Open finalist and former Grand Slam champion a wild card, especially given it's his last.
Well, I'm not. It's hard for me to talk about people getting wild cards. It's the French Open, and he's Austrian the last time I checked. So I understand that a lot of times those tournaments want to give it to their countrymen. That's one of the perks of having a major. That's one. Two, they already have to give away a U.S. one, and I guess a British one. Do the Australian get one also or no? How does that?
Yeah, they all get one.
They all get one. So you're not left with that many for your countrymen if you're giving them away to Dominic Thiem. Yeah, I understand why people, he deserves it. He was a great player, but he's also been back on the tour now for quite some time. And his ranking isn't high enough to get in. So he's not playing at the level of the guy that was making the finals.
Let's assume that. Yeah, you're right about that.
I'm fine with it personally, but
I'm 95% of the time I'd be with you on this, and I'd be like, you know, don't complain about who gets a wild card and who doesn't. It's up to the tournament. Nobody deserves it. That's why it's a wild card. Fairness has never been what this is about. However, and by the way, the ability to go deep in the tournament, definitely not what it's about, right? Like if you look at the calculus of, say, let's give Venus Williams a wild card. She doesn't have a chance to make a run. What she does do is you put her in a stadium, she goes on TV, and she creates what is an intriguing first round, at the very least, an intriguing first round match that people want to watch. And to me, that's what the function of a wild card is: generate maximum interest in your tournament. So while I'm always on the don't complain about wild card side, 95% of the time, because these tournament directors are usually making decisions that help their event, in this case, I think you're shooting yourself in the foot. You're doing the opposite of helping your event, because people badly want to watch Dominic Thiem play a match, I believe, at this US Open. And I don't think the same could be said about Harold Mayo, the Frenchman ranked 130 in the world.
You're right worldwide, but in France, they might want to see old Harold. I'm not sure. As far as for a spectator. And I guess the other point, you're right. You're right about the wild card. That's what they should be using. The criteria you're talking about, what's going to bring interest to the tournament. The majors don't need it as much because there's interest always in those majors. But you are right. It would have been fun and exciting to be able to talk about, especially in the job we now do when we're on television, to talk about Dominic Thiem against, I don't know, Novak Djokovic first round. So two big names going at it right away from the first day. Something like that is a great story for that 1 minute. So I understand your point. I don't know if the French, it's hard for me because I felt so, I got so annoyed at the US Open because I got a wild card when I was 15. And then I never got a wild card again. And I didn't need it until I had wrist surgery in 92, I think it was. And so my ranking had dropped and I didn't take a protected, I didn't have a protected ranking because I missed 5 months and I should have just sat out one more month. And that summer leading up to the US Open, I went from virtually not ranked to, I won a challenger. I went quali and won two rounds in the DC tournament. Went around in New Haven, which was a big tournament at the time. Anyway, I played well enough to probably get up to like 130, 140 in the world by the time the US Open started, not when the entry list was. And I was probably the second or third highest ranked American not in, and I didn't get a wild card because I was older and they gave it to a bunch of young guys. And I remember getting annoyed at that at the time. So, I mean, you know, obviously I understand why fans wanted Dominic Thiem and not Harold Mayo.
Sorry, Harold. I don't mean to make you the poster boy of the undeserved wild card. He's a good player. I've seen him before. Let's go to the next one. Michael, assuming that none of the top four win Roland Garros at this moment, who would be your pick to win? Steph, Sasha, Rude, Rublev, Fritz, someone else? So let me just jump in and say, I mean, I think people will be going a little bit overboard in describing the men's side as super, super wide open, because I don't think there are 10 players who can win it or anything like that. I think that's too high a number. I do think in that tier two, when you get outside of Djokovic, Sinner, Alcaraz, where if things were normal, I think we'd be looking at those three as the main favorites. I think it's the tier two and some of the players you named, Tsitsipas and Rude and Zverev, and then maybe even, I don't know, Medvedev, maybe if he plays a lot better than he did in Rome. That's where the opportunity is for those guys, I think, to maybe win this thing. Of those names, Jimmy, is there one you like the best? Is there one where you see it?
Well, From a tennis standpoint, yes. But I don't trust the mind. And that's Zverev. I think Zverev has everything he needs to have to win majors, even when Djokovic and those guys were playing. He's sort of a bigger version of Djokovic in some ways. He stands further back in the court, I know, but he's so rangy. He can serve huge. His backhand is pure as you'd like. Covers the court incredibly well. Can hit with power and winners when he needs to. It's just when it comes down to the biggest moments, his serve and his forehand will probably let him down. But he's the guy that has the game to be able to do it. And do we know? I don't even know. Alcaraz and Sinner. Do we know where they are? I'm hearing not play. I don't know.
The reports are that a doctor has told Sinner to rest and not to play. The decision hasn't been made, but it's looking pretty shaky. Alcaraz, what I know about him is he's hitting, but not at full speed yet. He is not hitting forehands at a full capacity at this point because of the forearm, but I do think it's looking much more likely that Carlitos is at least going to play.
If Alcaraz can get, I don't trust him that much right now, actually, but if he could get slowly into the tournament, so have a couple of matches early where he hasn't had to extend himself too much, as it goes on, he would be dangerous, obviously, for everybody. You know, Rude is a guy who I'm not as enamored with his game, but I do think that mentally he's unbelievably strong. And it might come down to, and Tsitsipas, he amazes me because he's got a weakness, a glaring weakness on the backhand, but it's not as easy to exploit on the clay. He seems to be able to get away with his backhand, looks a little bit more solid on the clay when he has a little more time, I guess, and he can back up enough and it does, you know, but it's hard to win majors, I would think, with a weakness. And Rude's backhand to me is a little bit of a weakness as well. So there's two guys with a weakness that you can see. Can they win a major? Maybe in this time frame. Rublev can't get past the quarters, right? Not yet.
I think this might be the one. I got to see the draw, but
until he gets to at least a semi, because he's been one of the best 10 players in the world for a long time now, and to lose quarters every single time, it seems like at this point it's a mental thing. And I'm sure when he gets to the quarters and they're in the press before, the press is going to say, you think you're going to finally win a match in the quarter? And it's just going to put all those thoughts back into his head and make that match. If he gets past the quarters, maybe then Rublev all of a sudden, I'll say, has a chance. He's got to get to the semis first, though, because he's got to get past that match.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy. And I don't even think at this point, I think usually
doesn't
the press.
Who. Yeah.
And I don't think the press needs to remind him. I think this is one of those things that's so big that the awareness level.
But the press will remind him.
The press will remind him. 100%.
Put it away, it will be asked.
Yes,
so
100%. I'm with you. I think this is a hard question to answer. Zverev, we've both watched Zverev for what, like 8 years now at the top of the game. And it's like, you can look at the tennis and be like, I think he's going to do this. I think he's going to do that. But at the end of the day, it's like, he needs to prove that in crunch time that he can do it, because it's broken down for him too many times.
And that's the problem. He's proven that he can't do it.
Exactly. Right. So it's hard for me.
Yeah, the team final at the U.S. Open, two sets to love up.
Yeah.
And lost a two-set lead yet in his career. Anyway.
I'll tell you, of that group, I think Tsitsipas is the person who I think I'm the highest on right now, because I do think he is fearless on big points. He looks to make things happen. Yes. And, I mean, right now, the backhand in the baseline rallies and even the return – it doesn't look that exploitable to me at the moment.
No, you're right. It doesn't. I don't know what happened, because it was horrible for about a half a year. He was barely hitting the ball on the strings when you got it into his backhand. And you're right. At the moment, it looks pretty good. And it, and I also agree with you that mentally, if he has the opportunity, he's a guy that believes he's gonna go ahead and win if he can, you know, if he has the chance.
Right. Some people might push back on us and they'll say, look, he's got a bad record in finals. But I mean, I just think from watching him play over the years, I don't fear that if he gets a short ball on the forehand on a big point, that he's not going to rip it into a corner.
Three.
Yeah.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, let's go to the next one. It is from AK. It's an interesting one. It got 24 likes, so a lot of people are interested in hearing our take on this. Is it time to stop hyping up Draper? I was one of the first people to notice his talent and thought that by now he'd be at least top 20 in the world, but whether it be injuries, tough draws, or tight losses, he struggled to string together a few good matches in a row. I know you're a fan of him, as I am, but it seems he's unfortunately underperformed the last few years. Thoughts on Jack Draper?
Yeah, I also have felt like Jack Draper is a top 20 player in the world. And then from that point on, it's sort of, you know, who's believing, who's got the hot streaks at the right time, that kind of thing. He has been injured so much that he's never been able to have that continuity to see, to keep the confidence, to keep rolling. Even when he's playing well, in the, I don't know, he wins a couple matches in a tournament. I remember the US Open, when he was first coming in, he had made quarters in Canada, and then he's playing in the US Open. And I think it's maybe third round against Hatchinoff. And he won the first set and was, I don't know, he was serving for a two-set lead or a two-set-to-one lead. He ended up pulling out of that match, I believe. And I remember watching that thinking he's kind of dominating Hatchinoff a little bit, the part that I was watching. This, and I was thinking this guy's going to be good. And then he disappears for a while because he gets injured again. The thing that worries me is it feels like some of those injuries shouldn't be lasting as long as they last. He's gone for a little bit too long or too easily. It's very hard, and I don't want to throw this name under the bus, but Kei Nishikori, I know well enough. I see him all the time at the academy here. He will not play with a little bit of pain. He's so afraid because he's had surgery. So as soon as something starts hurting, he's done. He's not going to play for a while. He's going to wait till that pain goes away. Very tough to do. I don't remember playing very often without something hurting. You know, when you're playing day in and day out on the tour and playing matches, at the intensity that it takes. I'm a little worried maybe Draper has a little of that in him, that, ooh, it hurts. I better not take a risk and I'm not going to play. I'm not sure if that's the case, but I get it. That worries me that that is. And then, as they said, tough draws when you're not ranked high and you're not seeded, you're going to have to beat some great players to get that ranking up to where you're seated. I think once he gets his ranking, once he has the breakthrough again, if he's not injured, he's a top 20, top 25 player for sure.
Yeah, I see that. That's all understandable. I mean, I would say the only thing is he's been healthier this year and he's up 20 ranking spots from the start of the year, about 20 ranking spots. It hasn't been as meteoric as I thought it would be if healthy. I thought if Draper stays healthy for 6 months, he's going to be top 20. That hasn't happened. But I'm also like, I do think I haven't given up at all with him. And I think it's also fair enough to look at the positive side of that and to say, okay, he's actually had a healthy 6 months. Yes, it hasn't resulted in the rise that I thought it might have, or that many of us thought it might have. But I mean, it's still progress. It's still progress from where we were at last year. So I'm kind of glass half full right now with Draper, even if it hasn't been exactly what I thought it would be.
He has to have another big breakthrough week.
Yeah,
he's had those in the past where he's had a big week and had some big wins. He needs that again. And then I think you'll see it continue if his body holds up. So, but he's going to be there eventually, I think.
This one is from Jack. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. It's very developmentally focused. How do you think the technique on tour will change over the next couple of decades? I personally feel that the ability to absorb and redirect pace is becoming more and more important as the game speeds up. And while pace generation is still important on clay, it's not as big of a deal on the other surfaces. Do you agree? And if so, does this imply that more compact strokes will be the change of the future? Seems like the most exploited shot in the modern game is the forehand with a big take back.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I actually like the question because at the end of the day, what you're trying to do as a player is take time away from your opponent. That's what makes them feel uncomfortable. And there's two ways to do it. Take a mighty wallop with racket head speed and make the ball go fast. Take time away that way. Or take the ball really early. And I talk about this sometimes with some of the students because I sort of use today, everybody wants to hit the ball hard. Everyone's taking big cuts. All the kids, that's what they see. They see someone smashing a ball. And so that's what they want to do. And they don't really see the game as well. So occasionally I'll, you know, tell the story of how when I used to play McEnroe, I always felt like an idiot because I'm taking this giant swing, creating all the pace, and he's just running up with literally no swing and bunting the ball, but right off the ground, and it's getting back to me in a hurry. I felt like rope-a-dope. He was the one in control, even though I was creating the pace, which is the point of that question. Do I think that's going to happen more often? That is another skill, by the way, that's not so easy to, you have to recognize the court so well to be that guy that has compact strokes and takes it early and redirects. You need to notice that the ball's going to land short. And not everybody has that sort of ability or that eye that recognizes that quickly enough. So that is another skill, but I'm sure if you're on the pro tour, you probably, and that's your style, you're going to have that skill. There's certainly a place for the redirectors. Yes. Taking time away. But then if that's the way that everyone starts playing, then you're going to need someone that swings hard again. So it's always a little bit of a give and take on how that's going to roll. I think it's safe, and maybe because I swung hard and, you know, I feel like it's almost safer to swing fast than redirect because you can create spin. When you're nervous, you just put more spin, but you still always swing fast. And I would think redirectors with short, compact, tighter swings, when they get tight, it'll get ugly. But, you know, I'm not sure.
Yeah, like I think it's a well thought out question. And I like the theory, but I see things going the other way right now. I see a lot of pace generators, backing up further behind the baseline. Like Joao Fonseca is playing way behind the baseline and is obliterating everything. And he, you know, with the modern technology, there's a lot of margin there. And I don't see as many Andy Murrays and Novak Djokovic's who are hugging the baseline and have great timing and are taking it early and redirecting. Like I see it going the other way right now.
Well, what worries me the most is I don't want to see a bunch of 6-7 guys that can serve 150 miles an hour. And I don't know, it takes away some of the art of the game. I like the game to be able to have some chess pieces to it. And if it's all power, it's going to bother me a little bit. I'm going to want, so hopefully you're wrong, but you know, you're probably not. You're probably not. I mean, it's hard to combat.
I'm just making, it's just on my end, it's just an observation. Like it's not really forecasting into the future. I think you make a great point that there's a push and pull that, you know, when things go too far one direction, it can kind of like, I think we've seen that with return positions. You have return positions getting further and further and further back. And now it's like, hey, serve and volley's back.
Well, yes, exactly. Serve and volley's going to come back at some point. It should, and it is starting to. The other thing that amazes me on the men's tour, it was happening in yesterday's match in Rome. Zhang was playing Tabilo, and Tabilo's second serve was, you know, he was popping it in there at about 60 miles an hour. It was nothing, just rolling it in the middle of the box. And Zhang's got huge power, but he's waiting for it in the fence. And I couldn't, he was struggling. He actually running up and missing some of the returns because they were short. And that's the part that always surprises me. They don't take into account their opponent and what their opponent's doing. They just play their game.
Yeah.
That part I don't like, but anyway.
All right. For the last one, do we want to talk about players complaining more? Fritz and Rublev comparison, Murray changing rackets, or the Zverev Tsitsipas head to head? Which,
why don't we do like a lightning round and I give you with like a sentence on each of them or something?
Okay, let's do that. All right, this one's from Max Dangvu. I love this comment. Hi Gil, I've noticed that since tennis resumed after the COVID pause, players have become much more vocal in their complaints about tournaments, ball and court conditions, umpiring, scheduling, etc. At least I think it's much more publicized than pre-2020. Why is this the case?
Well, I think we've always complained, the players, about scheduling and all those things that he just mentioned. We've always, you know, we're all prima donnas. And maybe now with social media and more people on social media, that's just what they're hearing. But it's always been there. It hasn't really changed that much.
Yeah, so more public.
The complaining has always been there. It's okay. Just now you hear about it.
That's good enough for me.
Yeah.
From Bakugo, is Fritz just a less consistent version of Rublev? What changes would you make to his game to make him a consistent top 10 player? Two questions there, really.
No, I don't think Fritz is a less... first of all, I think Fritz has actually more, his serve is huge. So he's got more opportunities in some ways than Rublev. And he also has this thought process that he's great. Like he believes he's going to be number one in the world. And that's something that is important to have if you're going to have great results. So he has that. He just doesn't have a mid-court game to speak of. He doesn't want to work on coming in. He doesn't want to learn how to volley. He doesn't want to take the short ball. He just does what he does really well. And I guess there's times when it can, you know, be blunted a little bit. He stands behind the baseline and hits both sides beautifully hard and consistent and serves huge. And, you know, just needs, he doesn't have a mid-court and a volley sort of game at all. So if he ever needs it in a match, it's not there.
Or elite defense. He's not that top end.
No, because right. He's looking to defend ever. He's trying to bully you. And that's it. He's got one strategy. This is my strategy. I'm going to bully you. And if he's not able to do it, he probably loses that day.
Yeah. By the way, he says that he is working on transition game, volleys, moving forward. But he also admits that he's made no progress in getting really, at least, I don't want to say he hasn't gotten any better at it, but he hasn't gotten good enough at it that he wants to do it in a match.
Yes, exactly. So maybe he's working on it, but it's just not his thing, obviously. Yeah.
Okay, next one from Gibon the Great. Hey, Gil, I know you've touched on it in the draw, but can you say anything about the Murray to Yonex move? Do you think that this hints at him potentially playing for longer, or is this just Andy's personality that he would make a racket change months before retirement? I guess forget the retirement aspect of it. I'm not that interested in that, but what do you make of Murray changing to, I believe it's a Yonex E-Zone 100?
I wish I knew equipment better to know. Is that a racket that has more power?
Much more than what he has used his whole career.
Well, then he's doing what's best for him right now to play, because that's what he needs. He needs to have Murray's problem in this whole comeback is that he lost a step with the hip, and he always won with his defense because it was immaculate. He also has weapons. He just never used them. He never took the risk. He hated to miss. So why take the risk of going big when I can just grind you into the dirt eventually anyway with no risk? At some point, maybe finally he's, you know, every time I call his match, I say this. He needs to start stepping in and ripping. He does. He's got to be okay missing and taking more risks, but it's the only way he's going to survive in these tournaments and be able to do well. And so maybe this is finally him saying, yeah, maybe I could use a racket that gives me a little more juice and I can try to finish points and maybe I'll miss more. But, you know, in the end, it's going to be the only way I can win. So maybe it's just a sign of him trying to be good.
Agreed. Exactly. I mean, I hope that he can play, you know, a different brand of tennis and threaten more with his forehand.
Yeah.
With this new technology. It's been a torturous process for him. He's tested a ton of rackets. He's always gone back to old reliable. So it just looks like he's finally managed to pull the trigger. Last one. It is from user. Why is it so hard for Zverev to play against Tsitsipas? Of course, Steph is a great player, no doubt about that. But from an eye standpoint, Sasha always looks like a stronger player overall for me, with better serve, return, and backhand. I would get the head-to-head if all matches were on clay, where they're both great, but at hard courts, in which Zverev is overall clearly the better player, he still can't get the upper hand. And this comment topical because they might meet in Rome. They're looking like the favorites in Rome right now.
Yeah, they might. I guess the answer to that is the one shot that seems that players really have trouble dealing with is Tsitsipas's forehand. When he's taking it early, no one seems to read it. So if he hits a ball big and you go a little bit short, he does two things. He's very quick to get to that short ball with his forehand. He doesn't set up, wait, and rip. He gets to that forehand in a hurry. So that takes time away from you getting yourself back in position. And for whatever reason, people always guess wrong. He always hits it where you're not going. You know, I haven't played against him to know why you can't read it. But obviously, I got to trust that you can't read it. And one of the reasons Zverev does as well as Zverev does is how well he defends. He's a defender, even though he's got a huge serve, you know, in the miles per hour. But his natural state is to defend. And Tsitsipas is a guy, as you mentioned, when you were saying you think he can win the tournament, the Roland Garros, he's a guy that's not easy to defend against. He's a guy that you have to take it to that backhand. You gotta break down the backhand. If you're trying to beat him by grinding, he's gonna be all you can handle.
Totally with you. Yeah, I think Tsitsipas is just he has a more proactive mindset. Spot on that he's difficult to defend against. So I mean, when I picture them in neutral situations, I just see Steph as the player who is more likely. I think I've used this terminology already with him. He makes things happen. He's more likely to make something happen. That said, the head-to-head is surprising to me. Like, if I didn't know what their head-to-head was, I would expect
it. I actually don't know what their head-to-head is, so what is it?
Okay, let me get that, because I don't have that up right now, but let's take a look at it. And by the way, with Zverev being a big server, that's something that Tsitsipas can struggle with. So that's another area where you would think that Zverev could get more wins against him, but Zverev is 5-10 career against Tsitsipas.
Tsitsipas was also, just to give you the other example of defender, Demonar, I believe it's 11-1.
Yes.
Tsitsipas now. Just to give you an idea of how tough he is to defend against. Demonar is a good defender, moves incredibly well, doesn't have enough offense, and Tsitsipas just chops him up.
Yeah. And then this will post after the match is over, but he's about to play Nicholas Jarry in Rome, who he has a losing head-to-head against. And that's a guy who just attacks every ball, green light.
Oh, yeah. That isn't a good matchup at all. That's who Tsitsipas plays now? Yes. That's a bad matchup. The only advantage Tsitsipas has is how far they are in the tournament. Jari's not accustomed to being there in a 1,000. So will he get tight when he's green lighting? We'll see.
Everyone listening will know the answer. Thanks, Jimmy. Yep. This has been awesome. Love talking tennis with you. Love that we always get your unvarnished thoughts. You're my favorite no BS tennis analyst.
No, thanks, Gil. Be good. We'll see you soon.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.